Hello, Wi-Fi Pioneers. Welcome to episode 7 of the Wi-Fi Pioneer Podcast. We are your hosts, Colt and Remington. Say hi, Remy.
Hey, what's up, guys?
So last episode, episode 6, we wound up cutting it short. And the reason being was a family member wanted to talk to me about their new business venture. And I thought what they meant by business venture was that they had started a business. Turns out, said family member is caught up in the current MLM of the week, and it's masquerading as a financial advisor. And I sat through 30 minutes of my life I'll never get back. So we're starting there today because I just hate MLMs. I'm disgusted by the model and its predatory nature and how it preys on the gullible, to especially the way it preys on women and stay-at-home moms, to try to convince them that they can be, you know, building a business and contributing to the family and all this. And really what it does is just fleeces them for a lot of money. I hate the whole model of it. And I'm not trying to bash on the people who are getting pulled into the MLMs. I really want you to understand it's not you I'm frustrated with. It's the people preying on you. And I stay away from the MLMs. A good way to know if that's what's being pitched to you is if after 30 minutes of the sales pitch, you have no idea what they're selling you or what the service or product is, that's an MLM. It's 30 minutes of nonsense with hopefully you'll sign on. And it's just bad all around. They're not a real business. They're not a real model. And when they masquerade as financial advisors, it's even worse. That really ticks me off.
What were they advising you on financial matters?
That was the thing. After 30 minutes, I really wasn't sure what they were trying to sell me. There was a little piece of life insurance, and there's like, you know, Roth IRA, and maybe like, I can't tell if they were going to give me stock tips or if I was just going to hand them money and hope to get money back someday. Like it was so vague and all over the place. It's like they had a slide for everything you could think of money wise. And I don't know if it was budget planning, like the words retirement planning were there, and asset management. And they had this asset map, which was just a circle. And I just kept thinking this is a circle of failure, but there was never any actual words. There was nothing of substance to it. And of course, that's what all the alarm bells are for me, because if after 30 minutes you're talking to me and I don't know what you're talking about, you're trying to scam me. You're trying to fleece me out of something.
Why do you think they were specifically pitching financial advice of all the MLMs? Like, why would finance be something you pitch through an MLM?
I'm not sure the exact model, and maybe it's not. Maybe this isn't a perfect example, because MLMs tend to be a pyramid scheme of I'm going to sell candy bars and make money, but if you sell candy bars under me, then you make money and then I make money off of your candy bars, and it goes down the list of the pyramid, right? Every person in your downline, you make a percentage of a percentage. The financial advisor ones, it tends to be like half real business, in the sense that, like, yeah, they're going to help you allocate money into funds. But then it, somewhere along the line, it's like, hey, if you recruit somebody under you, then you get a percentage of the money they manage. So like you go from being a customer to being the advisor, and anybody you advise, you get a percentage of what they have, and the guy who recruited you gets a percentage. So it's like a hybrid of a pyramid scheme and a financial advisor scheme, only all that happens is you wind up broke. And I'm not going to name them by name because I don't want to get the legal liability, but essentially I put in the name of this advisory thing into my search engine, and the very first term that came up was their name and scam next to it. Like, that's so the fact that my relative is involved in this, and like, if you're too stupid to use Google, you don't deserve money.
I kind of wonder if maybe the reason that they're selling financial products through an MLM is because they want to take advantage of the trust networks, you know, like friends signing up friends, obviously. But maybe that's because finance has such a predatory reputation, right? I mean, throughout history, bankers have always been considered greedy. Bankers are screwing you out of your assets. Bankers are selling you crap, all that stuff. Maybe the reason they're trying an MLM with finance is that people will trust their relatives, trust their neighbors, and then they can and then they can sell you crappy stuff.
You know, maybe some of these things have, like, the MLMs changed shape, especially in the last 10 years, they've changed shape. But if you really look at the history, they've been around for a long time. They just adapt to the current technology trends. And yeah, but they all, whether it's the financial advisory or the other models, they rely on the predation of friends and family first, because these are the people that trust you. And it's also hard to tell your family members no. It's, well, at least it should be. If you come from my family, it's really easy to speak the truth, because we don't like each other. You know, it's just kind of an advantage of being from the East Coast. You know, bluntness is built in. But now they, aside from the financial specifically, they, when around 2010, 2012, as Facebook took off and then the other social medias, that's when they changed their model for the MLM from being door-to-door nonsense to go on the family method, because they love stay-at-home moms and gullible women. And I don't mean that to bash on women or stay-at-home moms, but what you wind up happening is a wife who's not able, or woman unmarried, who's unable to contribute to the household. She's making minimum wage or making no money. And they come in selling this grand idea of, like, you can work from home, you can be a stay-at-home mom, you control everything, and you can bring in all this money to help your husband or your kids and family. And you get to build your own business. And it's like, one, if you don't have an LLC, you are not your own business. You're not. You're just somebody else's employee. And the product they're shilling is always garbage, because if it was a good product, it'd be in the stores. You'd be able to buy it on Amazon or go into a store and purchase it. So if it's not on the shelves, it's a garbage product. And then the service is the same way. It's because the whole thing is built so that the guy at the top can always make the money. And, you know, I've actually met a few people in real life who were at, like, not the top of the pyramid, but they were maybe three or four levels down. And man, I just, the urge to hurt them was immense. 'Cause it's like, you are such, you're grifters that are just living off of the people down the line. And it's like, you're not the success story. You're the successful predator story. You're a bad person for the success, 'cause you are contributing nothing and you're taking from these people.
Are there any MLMs that are quality products? I'm thinking about, you know, there are all these, in Utah, there are all these MLMs, and especially, like, when you get into anything like essential oils, they always seem to be MLMs.
It's possible some of the oils aren't complete garbage. Like, maybe I may have been a little harsh on saying they're all complete garbage, but for the most part, the things you're buying, if it's not available in a retail store, it's probably not a good product. Two examples come to mind of something that's a quality product, but maybe not. I don't know if it's the top quality. It's certainly probably not. But there's the kitchen knives and the vacuum cleaner come to mind. God, what the hell are they? Cutco knives and a Kirby vacuums. They come to mind because they were the pre-internet. They're like right up there with Amway, with that they've been around as MLMs forever. But the knives aren't complete shit, and the vacuum cleaner is a powerful vacuum cleaner. Now, is it worth purchasing from these people? I don't think the value is that high that it's worth getting around this nonsense. But they at least provided a product that, if you, whether you got suckered into buying or suckered into selling, it's a product that'll be there for the rest of your life and usable the rest of your life, probably to remind you that you got scammed. But the pricing, so full disclosure, I did sell the knives when I was 18 years old, before I knew what an MLM was. Okay. That's why I know, because I still have a set in my kitchen as a daily reminder that, yes, you did do this. But I did the math on the price of the knife versus what it cost. And it's like, when you looked at my commission and then my boss's commission and his boss's commission, there is somewhere between an 80 to 90% markup on the price of those knives. So yeah, go ahead and buy them from the MLM person, but understand that you're paying 90% over what it's worth.
Interesting. So I think this is actually, I know we're going to talk about finance, but I think this is a good segue into e-commerce and digital marketing, because I actually think that this is part of why I encourage people to go that route versus the SaaS route. Obviously, my bias about SaaS is clear, especially SaaS that's funded by VCs, because you know they focus on SaaS companies that have all these network effects and high switching costs that prevent you from leaving and such. But the other reason that I'm really into, or at least bullish on e-commerce and digital marketing, is that the cost of producing most of the things we need and consume in our daily life is dropping drastically, as we talked about before, this technological deflation. But people still spend their wealth. And as we acquire more and more wealth, people are spending a lot of it. And there's only so many purchasing decisions you can make in a day. So it's not like you're going to buy 50,000 things. You still buy, you know, people still make like similar amounts of purchasing decisions. So what that means is that they're spending an ever-increasing sort of representation of wealth, and it's costing less and less to produce those things. So that means widely expanding margins, and those margins go to the marketing, right? They go to digital marketing. And so this is like, this is where all the margins are in my mind. I mean, you can build physical products. It's great. There's really good sustainable models there. That do lots of great things for yourself and the people around you. But man, digital marketing is just insane. It's like, it's kind of like in the past, people could always start luxury brands and such to make a ton of money. And you'd be just kind of blown away because you'd be like, that person didn't really know anything about business. Well, they had friends who spend lots of money and they know how to sell an image. That's what you need to sell a luxury fashion brand or any kind of fashion brand. And then because these people can spend, you know, $150 on a pair of shorts that costs $2 to make, I mean, the margins are insane, right? So it's funny you bring that up about MLM margins, because I sort of view digital marketing as having similar margins now and for the foreseeable future. Your ability to capture someone's attention and convert that into a sale is many, many, many times more valuable than actually producing a product, in my opinion.
Yeah. And, you know, digital marketing, depending on where you're marketing at, whether it's through Google ads or Facebook ads, TikTok, whatever, social media, or the web itself, if the platform you're using is good at it, is good at the algorithms, you can make your products reach the people who are most likely to buy them. So as opposed to like buying a billboard and just letting sheer volume of people on a freeway see the billboard and hoping a percentage of them buy, you can dial that digital marketing in so that, you know, 50% of the people that see your ad are potential customers, or sometimes even more, depending on the product. You can really get it to where, like, Instagram is really good at this. Your product, especially if it's something fitness related, it'll get to the fitness Instagram people with very relative little work on your end. And if it's a good product, I mean, you're hitting 90% of the people viewing your ad are people who are potentially going to buy. That's huge. Where else can you do that?
Here's the one caveat, other consideration, is that most digital marketing is built on SaaS platforms that are the very thing that I rail against, right? They own a specific network. They own the ground under your feet. And if the woke mafia gets a hold of it, you may lose that entire platform, right? So we actually just saw this happen with Twitter. You saw all these people protesting Elon taking over Twitter, and then there was all this commotion and rumors about Twitter, you know, going offline or Twitter collapsing. And you saw a lot of people whose primary, or a lot of accounts whose primary method for interacting with their audience was on Twitter, scrambling to adopt another platform, scrambling to go to Instagram, scrambling to go somewhere else. That's the very definition of building on someone else's land. Network effect SaaS is a digital feudal society. It's a very weak primitive property right and governance structure that makes a few kings and dukes, but otherwise creates a lot of poverty and slavery. They own the ground under your feet. So keep that in mind when you're building out your ability to market. You're probably building on a SaaS platform, and it's probably something that could deplatform you at any time.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, the advice is always out there when you start advertising: don't advertise on one platform. I mean, the main reason you don't advertise on just one platform is because you want to hit as much of the audience as possible. But the second reason is because if you get canceled on one, you don't get, you've got something to fall back on. So trying to reach your audience in multiple avenues is always the best way to go.
Yeah. And So we can't do that much right now about the fact that you're building on somebody else's land. It's just the name of the game, but you can build in multiple places at the same time. I mean, to draw an analogy, think how bizarre it would be if you wanted to move countries, or the country you were living in, you know, fell into civil war and you wanted to leave and you couldn't take anything with you, right? You just got to leave with, you know, the stuff on your back. That's essentially what SaaS platforms are, especially like the marketing platforms, right? So you have to build in multiple countries at the same time. You have to build on multiple marketing platforms at the same time. So you're not beholden to any particular one of them. Now, the good news is we're making big progress every single day on sharing protocols and such that will allow people to use these platforms to tap into the bigger network and not be totally constrained to whatever SaaS platform network is, right? So the SaaS then becomes a conduit through which you tap into the broader network instead of being an island that they trap you on.
Yeah, and that's because there's a couple of things we're going to see happen. I mean, one, we saw, remember when Parler, when Trump got kicked off of Twitter, everybody was going to move to Parler, and Amazon and Apple just basically said, no, you're not, and shut down Parler. Just because they owned Parler's real estate, essentially digital real estate, shut them down. So that's one potential problem. The other thing we're looking at is, okay, so you decide, well, I'm going to advertise on Rumble and YouTube and Twitter and Gab and every competing platform. What happens when they start canceling you because you're running on the competitors? What happens when they throttle your account because of that? That making yourself woke proof is going to be a perpetual thing for the next decade because, like you said, you're vulnerable to the whims of the woke mob or whoever's controlling the SaaS platform. And it could actually bite you being on multiple platforms too, if you're on platforms they don't approve of, which is nonsense and blatantly un-American, but that's the world we're moving into.
Yeah, it is. It's very primitive property rights. We haven't established digital property rights yet. I think this is why Balaji is so bullish on crypto and why he spent so much time talking about it and not just about Bitcoin. And I'll be honest, this is not something I have not yet seen a lot of the potential that he's seeing on the crypto side. It's probably there. I just haven't seen enough yet to think that it's actually going to happen on crypto and not Bitcoin. But the reason I think he's so excited about it is it allows people to actually own their data. It allows people to decide where they want to live in the digital world, and nobody can constrain them and trap them in a specific domain like we have right now with these really primitive, I call them feudal property rights, because you really are. You're on a king's land, and he gets to decide what you do.
Yeah, and which it's just so funny you use that analogy too, because all over social media, everybody's calling each other kings and queens, and it's like, what is a king? Historically, what is a king? He's some bastard that was born into authority. He's done nothing to earn it. I mean, it's the ultimate entitlement. And now you're taking that into the digital world where some entitled little shit is going to kick you off his platform or her platform because you're not conforming to their woke ways. So, yeah, you can keep all your king analogies. I'll go ahead and stick with being a regicide.
And I should specify, I don't think all SaaS companies are bad. I think there are plenty of good ones, especially when software is a way to streamline what you're trying to do. The thing that I caution people against is these network effects, feudal SaaS companies where you're building on somebody else's ground and they own you. So if you're building a SaaS company, recognize which one of those two paths you're going into, because if you're in feudal SaaS, you are betting against all of these data sharing protocols that are being developed at the very moment that will eventually break through. So if you're sitting on a SaaS company right now, that's betting on its network effects to perpetuity, man, you better get rid of that thing. Not financial advice, but you're actively betting against technology, actively betting against it and betting against freedom. And man, if there are two things I would not want to bet against in the world, it's those.
Oh yeah, it's I mean, you only have to look through history to see that whatever technological hurdle was in front of us, we got past it. We always do. Whatever technology is currently in the way, like, you know, look at the growth of the internet since the 90s. It's just everything gets bigger and beyond what you could imagine. You know, it was a big talk back in when we started having the flip phones. It's like, we're at the Star Trek level of technology now, and now we've surpassed all the stuff you see on Star Trek for the most part. Obviously not the spaceships, but all the little computer gadgets they had, we have them all, and we have them better than they portrayed them on the show. So it's like we're outperforming our own imagination. If you're going to bet against that, you will lose.
Yeah, definitely. But like I said, I think that there are plenty of good SaaS companies that are solid businesses that use technology to their advantage and aren't explicitly just extracting wealth from their customers. I think the massively scaling SaaS companies, these ones with major network effects, I think they basically have two phases. One is the scaling phase where they're actually adding value because they're showing, you know, efficiencies and such, and conquering ground pretty quickly, and they have to convince people that that's a good thing. And then the exploitation phase, and there's a transition period between them, but like, for example, we talked about Airbnb. They're in the exploitation phase or extraction phase. You watch all these companies, they stop innovating and they just sit on their accumulated gains and extract wealth from the customers or their loyal subjects until people get sick of it and they overthrow that system or find a way around it. That's the basic SaaS game on these rapidly scaling SaaS companies. There's plenty of other good situations where, you know, you're creating a SaaS that somebody needs, and you're not depending on them and everybody around them. You're not locking them in, so to speak. They can come and go, but, you know, over time, the reason that network effect SaaS is so valuable, is because it overcomes the inherent, competitive nature of SaaS. Inherent competitive nature of SaaS is that it's really cheap and easy to build SaaS systems. For example, like, 14-year-old could build Twitter, or at least a basic operating clone of Twitter. And so that means that everybody can start this company and compete. Well, who wins? Whoever wins the network effect split scaling game. But that's the very thing that makes you subject to that king. So anyway, long story short, SaaS is a particular animal. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. If you amassed a huge SaaS company that's depending on nobody being able to scale the wall to the Berlin Wall to get out, man, you're massively betting against technology. But the other thing I want to mention was we just had a Black Friday, which is notorious for sales. And I know there's a lot of SaaS guys building companies right now. So I wanted to talk a little about when you offer discounts, what your discount strategy is.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to add, Root, before you get into that, with SaaS, really with anything, building ethically will help you in the long run. If you're able, you know, when you're chasing short-term gains by fleecing your customers because you can make a lot more money in the short run, it won't last forever. You will burn yourself out. Like you said, to be a SaaS company, to run unethically and to fleece your customers in the short term is going to set you up to be replaced by better technology down the road. So unless you're just looking to fleece people over the course of a few months or a few short years, don't build yourself into a corner like that. Respect your customers and be at the forefront of the next wave of technology. Don't set yourself up to be run out.
Yeah, I like to say, to use a dating analogy, selling SaaS is kind of like dating in a big city. Right, there's a never-ending stream of potential customers, and if you develop a bad name amongst a few customers, it doesn't hurt you that bad. Dating in a small town, if you develop a bad name, it's going to hurt you bad. And there's a lot of business relationships where you do not want to use the SaaS method of sales. Right, if you did that, you'd get run out of town really fast. SaaS companies. Yeah. Have very, very short-lived brands, very short-lived customer relationships. And so you have to understand that that game gives rise to a specific kind of sales relationship that may or may not be applicable for most other business relationships. obviously there's some fundamental truths in SaaS and fundamental truths in sales that are the same in SaaS. But that doesn't mean because you know how to sell SaaS that you should use those same tactics for a long-term relationship business. That could really backfire.
Okay. And, you know, I got more questions on that, but you started talking about Black Friday and discounts and stuff. I want to hear more about the discount. What particularly are you talking about? Like e-commerce, retail, where are you talking with your discount strategy and how you want to go with that?
So I'm focusing more on like specific brands. So if you're building a brand, which I think where most of the margins are, I don't think the margins are in Amazon sales and such. I think the margins are in building luxury products or specific brands with a specific image that people are willing to pay for. And in that circumstance, I rarely recommend somebody offering discounts. Discounts become the price of the product for anybody who's watching your brand. And if you have a brand, the reason you have a brand is because you have a loyal following, right? Somebody identifies with your brand viscerally, and they've been following it for a while. So they're going to know when you're offering discounts. And if you're offering discounts routinely, then that becomes the price of your product. And if they're not getting that price, now they're going to feel slighted. Not only that, but it erodes the actual statement of your product, especially, oh man, when you get into like Veblen goods and luxury goods, the last thing you ever want to do is offer a discount. And if you want the secret to making a ton of money, build luxury products, build this kind of stuff, because like we mentioned before, the margins are insane. You can have 95% margins in these products. Don't sacrifice your margins just to move product. That's like rule number one. You build an image, build a brand, protect that brand. Your customers will reward you. So the only time I recommend offering discounts is when you're trying to move inferior product. Let's say you're brand new to the market and you're developing, some sort of technology product. Sometimes it's perfectly advisable to offer a discount to your first customers for jumping in before it was well established, before you had something real to offer that every customer is going to recognize. Or at the end of the game, if you're trying to move stale product and you're having a hard time moving it, that's the only time. Other than that, if you're offering discounts, I think you're really punishing your most loyal customers.
Yeah, and I've seen that too in my Wi-Fi space where people will come out and they'll offer their product. They either come out the first month and they offer it at like 75% off because it's digital, and they think that that's it's a digital product, therefore they're not hurting themselves as bad. And a bunch of people scoop it up at these massive discounts and either never use it because it was cheap, or worse, they give it away for free for the first week, and a free product is worth zero. So people will download it, but they'll never use it. And then they get pissed when a month later, now you're charging three times as much because you're actually offering your real price. So I've definitely seen that. But there's also like the flip side of that is if you look in the retail space, never-ending discounts are just a marketing scheme. So take, you ever been to Harbor Freight? We call it the Chinese junkyard. It's all the cheap Chinese knockoff tools. Everything they have there is, it's stolen intellectual property of Americans. So it's all the it's essentially knockoff brands of power tools. But every week the store has a 20% off sale of everything. If everything's 20% off all the time, then it's just, that's a normal price. When you look at the big retail outlets across the U.S., month to month, the dollar price of a washing machine or a television never actually changes. They just say, well, this holiday it's 10% off, the next holiday it's 15% off, but the dollar price is always the same. How is it still a $1,000 washing machine when it's 10% this month and 20% next month? It's because they manipulate the price. They raise the price before the holidays so that they can give you a discount. And this has been a strategy for decades, and people know this, and yet they still get all foamy at the mouth for Black Friday sales. It's like you haven't saved anything. You paid the exact same amount you would have if we weren't playing this game. So once you open that box, if you're going to be discounting your product, then you're going to have to just raise the price so it can always be discounted.
Yeah, two additional thoughts. And I think Botide Zelkai does a great job of explaining why and showing you why it's important not to offer discounts as a routine service or something. And one of the other reasons why is that discount customers are the biggest pain in the ass. They will cost you 80% of your time. It really is the Pareto rule, Pareto distribution there. They will cost you so much time, and they are your lowest margin customers. So as a screening tool, discounts are not offering discounts is a great way to keep from getting sucked into those customers. And then the other thing is, I actually do think it's reasonable to offer the friends and family discount on a limited basis. And that's because I think that they implicitly understand they're getting a deal and that you're investing in the relationship. And that hopefully, you know, there'll be some sort of returned favor at some point. But if it's purely a transactional relationship, transactional customer, no discounts. I was just thinking about the, I just lost it. What you were mentioning before about, we can go on.
I was just going to say, like, when I've had my IRL business, we would have people, another type of the complainer discount people, where they every single time they always come back to you, but they complain every single time in order to get some kind of discount. And they'll tell you they can't help but brag about it. They'll tell you that the month before they went to your competitor and complained over there and got something for free as well. And once we identified these people, we would just basically blacklist them. And anytime they called us, it's like, we can't help you. We're booked out. We're perpetually booked and unable to help these people because they were just a pain in the ass. So yeah, when you have the perpetual discount shoppers, which really think about in your real life, do you know anybody who's a perpetual discount shopper, a professional bargain shopper that's not always broke? Like that's kind of your clue, right? These people that are always wheeling and dealing and trying to get 10% here and there, and yet they're always broke. Like, this is not something to wrap your head around. Yeah, as a consumer, don't get worried about all these discounts, because once you run a business, you actually understand how margins work, and either you're paying a good price or you're not. So the flip side of that is be a good customer, because, you know, it's just karma coming back to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Be a good customer. It will come back in spades. Yeah. So in a nutshell, your pricing strategy isn't just to protect your margins. It's to protect your entire business, because it down selects on the type of customers you're going to attract, so you can focus on just quality customers, just quality business relationships, and then you can take care of those customers, and it will come back in spades. I just remembered the other thing I was going to mention, which is in the finance world, when I was shopping for equipment loans, man, that sales strategy of just kind of burning through potential leads, you know, like having a really wide sales funnel at the top and then just chopping them down to just the people who are most desperate for your product. That is the exact process I went through as a customer trying to get an equipment loan. And it was infuriating to the point where I will never deal with any of those companies again. They are burned. They've burned their brand to me, and I will never come back to them for, you know, the $40 or $50 million of equipment loans we have coming. So, I mean, like, talk about a really, really stupid short-term decision. Now, I get that's the game they play, and it sucks, but I'm more than happy to compensate the couple brokers that gave me their time and we were able to build a good transaction, and I have no problem paying really good rates for them or really high rates for them, because they certainly earned it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny when you mentioned the frustration of getting that loan process. We talked our last podcast just about real estate and stuff and, you know, when to leverage and when not. But I worked with a man who the last time he tried to buy a house was such a pain in the ass, and he was jumping through so many hoops. The underwriters were incompetent and constantly asking him for paperwork he'd already sent, this, that, and the other. He finally just said, you know what, from here on out, I'm just buying cash. And he does now. He buys cash, not because he thinks financially it's the best way to go. It's simply because he's tired of dealing with the ineptitudes and bullshit from these banks that he said, it's just easier this way. And he cuts months out of the process of buying homes. So, you know, it's, when you are overly selective in that manner and you cut out too many customers, you just cut them all out. So as always, incompetence will ruin your business as well.
Yeah, the short term, the kind of like rule of thumb I use is long term games with long term people. Play long term games with long term people, customers, strategic partners, all that stuff. It's just such a better building business model. The opposite is just churning through customers left and right, and cannibalizing your brand. And I see a lot of tech companies do that, and they come on really fast and then they fade really fast. If you're actually building a quality business that's going to be around for a long time, take care of those relationships, take care of your brand, take care of your reputation.
Yeah. And that's, so you see two different strategies towards that with, especially in the e-commerce world. You'll have somebody who puts out a product, and then I'll use the MyPillow guy, even though he's always a discounter, but he puts out a pillow and everybody loves a pillow. So then he puts out a bigger pillow, and then he puts out bed sheets, and then he puts out slippers, then he puts out another, and he keeps adding products onto the end of it each time so that people who bought the pillow and liked it keep buying his stuff. The flip side of that is in the tech world, you see the subscription-based model where you buy a product. In order to unlock more and more features of the product, you have to subscribe and then a higher subscription. And then, you know, I can buy recording software for $5 a month, but for $10 a month, I get editing. And for $20 a month, it'll take the words and turn the recording into a text speech. And then for $25, and you just keep $5 servicing instead of just saying, hey, here's a $40 a month service and you get all this shit. It's, I'm going to nickel and dime you up to the $40 with one piece at a time. And those are frustrating models, but I get why they do it, because people will pay a low price and then add another low price on top of it one at a time versus buying an expensive product that has everything. It's the same dollar amount, it's the same services, but it's just a sales gimmick.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely appreciate sometimes being able to order a la carte, but I always feel like whenever I'm signing up for a SaaS service, I always feel like I'm getting fleeced somehow, either they're trying to trick me into a normal recurring subscription that I don't want. They're making it really hard for me to cancel. It's incredibly hard to find, you know, the account settings where you yeah. cancel. You just know the entire thing is built to trick you and keep you there. It's kind of like Hotel California.
Yeah.
And that vibe, I think everybody can smell that vibe, right? And if you get it on you, if you get that scent on you, it's really hard to dissociate it from your brand. I just feel like those are long-term damages. Like, I remember all the brands that I've been frustrated with, and I never let that go. So just keep that in mind as you're building a brand. And I think brands are where it is. I think brands are where the margins are. Personal brands, professional brands, all that stuff. I think that's where all the margins are. Protect that brand. Don't play the short-term boom and bust game that a lot of the tech companies play. Build for long term and you'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. You know, don't try to get the short term. Yeah, you've already said it. I'm just repeating you at this point, but you know, you want that long term quality. It just gets you so much further in life. Otherwise, it's just one short term grift to the next, and you meet those people in real life and you can never stand them. They're not good people. So why do you want to model your business that way?
Sometimes we talk about all these tech companies that aren't actually cash flowing and they've got these insane billion-dollar valuations. Imagine mm-hmm. what would happen if VCs and tech investors had to hold for 20 years. Imagine how much that would change their calculus. Imagine who they would invest in. But because yeah. they are quick, you know, quick to liquidity, quick exit, they're going to dump on you, a bag of shit. Yeah. And that totally, that model gets built into the DNA of all these tech companies. And then that DNA is what forms the customer relationship that makes most of these dealings so distasteful. You just always know you're getting screwed by these companies. You just know you are. You're like, okay, well, I really need this product, but man, I hate dealing with this company. Man, I wish somebody would put them out of business.
It's almost like going to a car dealership, but worse, because you can't walk away from a car dealership not feeling like you just got felt up by a priest. Like, it's always a horrible feeling leaving the dealership, and that the SaaS company is just double, triple that feeling. Like, you know, you're not getting the value for your dollar.
I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting myself because what we said just a few minutes ago about don't bet against technology. But man, I feel like there's so many of these companies that were raised by VCs. I feel like maybe 5 years after their exit, I want to short them as sort of just like the clock is up kind of thing. And I'm not telling anybody to do this. I just feel like it's the,
yeah.
I mean, you saw all of like the Kathy Wood stocks just get annihilated, right?
Yeah.
And you just get the sense that they're selling a bag of shit, just like all these Web 3.0 crypto tokens that crashed in the last year. And we found out they were just complete vaporware. I feel like it's just a rapid scale model of a lot of the tech companies that get pushed out of Silicon Valley. They're actually not making money. They're not quality companies. They're shells of companies created to present the appearance of profitability or future profitability in a low interest rate regime where the cost of capital is darn near free. So they get these insane valuations and then they're just dumping on you. I feel like they're just terrible investments.
Well, you know, I think it's that actually isn't a contradiction to what you said about not betting against technology. You just got to look at it at the right time scale. These people pop up, they have the new tech of the day, and then they're highly profitable. They don't maintain the tech. They don't make a competitive, or they actually allow competition to take them over. They make no, they don't take care of their customer. They rip their customers off. And then somebody else pops up with better tech to replace them. And it's just a much quicker scale of that replacement. So it's actually technology doing exactly what we want it to do. You made the product. It's great. You solved the problem. You didn't maintain it. You shit on me. This guy's got a replacement. I'm going over to him now. So we're seeing natural selection and technology work very well together. So I don't think that's a contradiction of your opinion at all. I think that just highlights, that actually highlights exactly what we're talking about.
All those, it almost makes it seem like, yeah, oh. Yeah, I hear you. It almost makes it seem like, go ahead.
You got it.
It almost makes it seem like, why is anybody buying publicly listed securities?
Yeah, because that's what's always been done.
They're dumping on you right at the time that company has reached its peak in the life cycle. Right? Software life cycle is very short. Unless you win some sort of effectively government-granted monopoly, like a Microsoft.
yeah.
Your life cycle is very short. Like I bet founding to peak of most of these companies is 10 years or less. And then the rest is just extraction phase until the network effects bleed off enough and they alienate so many customers that somebody is able to build something that competes directly with them.
Yeah. Well, and it's going to take a while to really flesh out that in the investing space. But when you look at pre-internet days, a company, you know, you'd buy stock in a company that would make you money for 100 years. You know, Sears was around forever. Ford is still around. Chevy is still around. Like you would invest in these companies. And yeah, in that 50, 80, 100 year cycle, they'd have decade or times where they were bad and almost bankrupt. But on the whole, they're always there. They're always producing a product. They're always innovating another product. They're always staying competitive. And it was a big deal for something to go out of business. Obviously, companies would come and go off the market, but you had some foundational rocks that you could depend on to at least always be there. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, right? Now you go into the tech space, and yeah, other than it seems like you're gonna get those government dollars if you're made of Cheese Whiz and touch children, SBF, Bill Gates, but the rest of them, you know, the ones that have to work on their merits, they pop up and they collapse. You know, the Kathy Wood stocks, what I was saying when we went to that constantly interrupting each other, the Kathy Wood stocks, they all performed spectacularly for a minute. You know, ARK, what, had a 200 or 300% boom in 2020, I think it was. Like, it was insane growth. And then those companies had to continue performing and it just done, you know, other than the nerd fanboys who are still getting excited over Kathy Wood. I mean, there's nothing there. That fund is a joke.
They also created a reflexive liquidity feedback loop where increased prices begat increased prices just because of the sheer lack of float of those securities in the markets. But I think there's something to this. Like, I think we've hit the point where publicly listed securities are no different, for the most part, than shitcoins. It's all the same game. It's just now we're seeing with crypto web 3.0, we're seeing it happen on such a short time scale that there's no denying what the game is. I think this just goes back to our point that you should spend your money on building your business, and the businesses around you, because if they haven't been priced by the capital markets and they're run by good people, that's your best source of returns. That's your best source of growth.
Yeah, it really is. So when we started off this podcast, I was talking a little bit, we're talking about the MLMs and the financial product MLMs. And you started to have some comments about financial advisors in general. I think I cut you off on that, but you definitely got some commentary on the financial advisor space. Just what did I stop you from saying? What were you going to get in with on that?
Just like anything, it's really important to measure the incentives, to assess and measure the incentives of somebody you're hiring for something. Incentives and contracts are everything. And obviously character and integrity matter, but over the long run, incentives are going to dominate everything. So what you'll probably notice about a lot of these investment advisors is they're commission-based. A lot of them are. And so they're getting paid to sell you crap. They're not fiduciaries. A lot of times they're pretending to be fiduciaries, which means that a fiduciary has some sort of responsibility to their client to do best by their client, but they're not, they're salesmen, and they're selling you dog shit. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've looked through these recommended portfolios by quote unquote investment advisors, standard run of the mill investment advisors advising your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, etc. And they're selling them the biggest bags of shit ever, with these insanely high fees, like 1-2% annual fees for some of these mutual funds and such. And it's all part of the same game, and they're just leeching off you. There's another model called, like fee-only investment advisors. So they just take, say, like 1% of your assets under management, and that's what their annual fee is for doing all your investment advising. But this is all just part of the central bank fractional reserve lending system. Because if money actually works, people don't have to push all their money into investments all the time, right? You can store money in cash, and it holds its value. In fact, it should increase in value because of technological deflation. So you don't always have to have somebody telling you what to do with your money. And then when you do see good investments, you can make those investments. But to be honest, I mean, I feel like their job is to sell you crap. They're way better stores of value, way better sources of growth than what most of the things you're going to find from the investment advisor industry. They're pushing that stuff on you because that's what the SEC lets them push on you. So just understand it's all a rigged game. I think it goes back to something we said in an earlier podcast. The three things you have to be able to know yourself better than the experts are your healthcare, your nutrition. Well, healthcare, nutrition, I guess, in one, education, how to get smart about things, and then finance, personal finance. Because the system will exploit you and ruin you if you don't understand those things better than the system.
Yeah, and it's this is one of those barriers to wealth we talked about in earlier episodes too. Because when you've got the net resource, when you actually have the wealth to say invest in a mutual fund, you know that their money is gonna, if they mess up, they're losing money alongside of you. And that's the whole skin in the game concept that Taleb talks about is, if I'm going to give you money to manage in the market, I want to know that you've got the equal or greater amount of money there so that if you lose my money, you lose too, and that way you're punished as badly for your failure as I'm going to get punished. But when I'm just handing you money and giving you a percentage, win, lose, or draw, what's the point? That's a horrible model to get into. So I would never work with a financial advisor that doesn't have more to lose than I do. That's, but along those lines, I would never take financial advice from somebody who has less money than me. Like that's kind of a thing too, with some of these financial advisors, when they're, You know, it's a 22-year-old kid who's driving a beat up car that his parents gave him. I'm like, yeah, this ain't going to happen, kid. Get the hell out of here.
What's that old saying about in a restaurant, if you have some kind of special or leftover food that's going bad, you put it in the soup and then people will eat it. That's kind of how I feel about marketing most of these investment products to Joe Public. Like, it's the leftovers. It's the stuff that got passed over by everybody who knows the game. And then you try to dump it on somebody who doesn't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, how many different ways can you rebundle the same stocks and bond portfolio? Yeah, that's what it keeps coming down to. Yep. You're not offering anything outside of that. And if that's the case, you know, you look at the last 100 years, how many of these things actually outperform the S&P 500, which is a pretty low bar for somebody who's good with arbitrage and good with investing. But as it turns out, 90% of the industry can't beat the S&P 500 just doing its thing.
Yeah. Just think about for a second, if you had a store of value that you didn't have to worry about losing its purchasing power, and in fact, it increased its purchasing power over time just through sheer economic growth, you wouldn't have to go and invest all your money in these products, right? So once you realize that, you realize all these investment advisors are totally dependent on the central banking fractional reserve system to continue their way of life. Their entire business is built on it. They need it to survive. And so because of that, they're actively going, not only are they giving you the crap investments, but they're actively going to dissuade you from the things that will make you free.
Well, yeah. And that's, okay. We should have said this earlier, and the regular reminder, this is not financial advice. This is just our opinions. And on that note, what I'm saying next is definitely not financial advice, just my opinion. A couple of years ago, stopped investing money in my Roth IRA and, 401k account, because I realized I could do more with that, $6,000 a year, $12,000 with me and my wife. I could do more of that money now with more exponential growth effects today than by putting it into a market and being able to access it 20 years, 25 years from now. And not just that I get better growth than the market will, than I should say my ability to pick winners and losers in the stock market, but it's also, it has an immediate quality of life effect on me now too. So I invest that money into myself. I invested it into my wife's business, and we increase the revenue and we increase our quality of life year over year at a rate far more exponential than hoping that when we're in our 60s, we can extract this and finally have some quality of life. So once that light bulb went off to me that you could do more now than later, it was like, what? It really made me wonder, what was the purpose of these 401k and Roth IRA vehicles? Like, what really is the purpose of getting you to sacrifice quality of life today in the hope of having it later?
Yeah, in something that they may have control of later, right? It may be hard to get your money out of those systems. But yeah, the case in point, the entire theme of this podcast is the system is out to screw you, but you can still win, right? So understand what the game is and win at the game. So know how to educate yourself, know how to keep yourself healthy and know how to feed yourself, know how to control your assets and protect your hard-earned savings. Very soon, I think people will think it was bizarre that we outsourced our wealth management to a system that was made to exploit us.
Yeah. Well, already we're starting to see that. And it's not just wealth, right? We exported our health decisions to people who had no vested interest in us, controlled by the people controlling who make them the medicines and the food, right? Look at we've been talking, I'm making a hard shift here from money to food. But it's the same principle, right? For the last 30 years, they've been telling us, eat less fat, eat more carbs, eat less protein, eat less meat, eat more processed foods. Don't go outside into the sunlight, stay indoors. Don't lift heavy objects because you'll hurt yourself. Get fat instead. Like, if you invert the food pyramid and do the exact opposite of everything that the health experts have told you, you come out healthier. You know, and then who funds all these studies that they're basing this nonsense off of about don't go outside? Well, it's the sunscreen people telling you that. Who funds the study that says that sugar's not good for you? Coke and Pepsi come together for in tens of millions of dollars to tell you sugar doesn't hurt you. And at every one of these studies that's completely opposite, you find either a pharmaceutical company or a government subsidized food company who has only money in mind, none of your best interests. So just across the board, going back to what you said, being across the board, not following the expert's advice, being healthy, managing your own money, self-educating, that keeps you way ahead of the curve.
You just made a great point a couple minutes ago too. It was, don't just view your savings as future income that you can use to survive and support your standard of living. Your savings can directly enhance the quality of your life and the people around you right now, right? Use that investment directly around you, build sustainable farms, build sustainable businesses around you in your town. Use that savings here instead of handing it off to the fiat money printing system that doesn't care about you at all, right? Imagine how much of a difference it makes for you starting a business, employing, three or four of the teenagers or, 20 somethings in the families around you, in a good quality job instead of them getting sucked into the corporate world.
Yeah. I keep telling my nephews and their friends, I keep trying to harp on them. Of course, nobody cares about the old man telling you what to do, but I keep trying to harp on them the importance of getting their own business going and finding a venture, learning the internet and finding their own, at least side hustle that they can grow. And it doesn't always fall on deaf ears, but it's such a struggle to make people understand, because I'm up against their Gen Xer parents and the boomer grandparents and my boomer in-laws all the time of explaining to them that their model of life is stuck in the 90s. And they're like, oh, that's a good job at, $40,000 a year. I'm like, 40,000 is a new minimum wage. Don't tell that kid that 40,000 is good. 40,000, he's never going to get married at 40,000. No woman's interested there. If he doesn't have six digits in his income, he's unmarriable. And rightly so. And
yeah.
And same with the investment advice, same with pensions. And, they get a job at the local county that has a pension. And I'm like, that pension won't pay for your food. Like, you need to do more. You're not winning, but you're stuck in the 90s with your mindset.
Yeah. So, Not only does the system encourage and perpetuate itself by creating this prestige about going to work for these big companies, which, by the way, if an employer needs prestige to attract you to work for them, you're getting screwed. That's it. and I mean, I am incredibly guilty of this myself. Like, I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. But so if they need prestige, they're screwing you somehow, and not only does encouraging kids to go off into the corporate, meat grinder, is it bad for them, but it just perpetuates the system. It just allows these, as we talk about, these managerial aristocrats to think that they're justified and legitimate and that they're actually producing for the world, and they're not. And as soon as all the productive people exit those companies and go to work for themselves or small companies around them, the entire system will change so rapidly, and all these people will literally fall out. The earth will fall out from underneath them, and they'll realize they never added any value. All they were doing was extracting from the people underneath them.
Yeah. Well, we just saw that with Twitter, right? What he wound up firing 3/4 of the people, and then the remaining 25%, 15% wound up quitting. So a total of 90% of Twitter gone. He got rid of that mid-level managerial vampires and all the dead weight that they pulled in under their wokeness hiring policies. He got rid of everything. And it's just very telling that when he tells his employees, hey, you're gonna have to do more than 4 hours worth of work a week, and they're like, we're leaving, okay, see ya, nobody's gonna hire you now.
Perfect example of a SaaS company that's in its extractive phase. Okay, it's not adding any value. It's purely coasting off what was already built by people a lot smarter and harder working than them. And now they're just collecting the, economists like to use the word rents, but I think it's a bad term. It's just not very clear, but they're just extracting all these cush profits for having contributed nothing, right? They're just They're just plantation owners.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's either they're so arrogant that they didn't see, they're so arrogant they didn't think that Twitter was going to be circling the drain without this purchase, and that they would just be able to live off of their lack of work forever. Or they simply didn't care and knew they'd be able to carry their, you know, their title, or expecting to carry their title to the next SaaS platform, to the next tech company, and continue extracting wealth from them on the same way, which we're probably going to see. If you keep an eye on that lawyer and the, I don't know if he was CEO or whatever, I forget his name, Parag something, like, let's see where they land next. Cause they had no value in the company. They did nothing to add to the value. Let's see where they land. Are they just going to live off of their massive severance, or are they going to go ruin another company?
Yeah. I mean, what a case in point of how extractive the system is. Like, what did he get? 45 million?
Oh, I'm not sure. I know it was two digit millions.
Yeah. Ridiculous. And wasn't even there a year, I think. But I think to tie this back to, you know, what actionable steps can you take? Obviously, we have a particular worldview. I think it's well-informed by having been burned so many times over the years. Right? We learned a lot of these things the hard way. No, you don't have to learn things the hard way. It's the story is pretty straightforward. The system is out to take advantage of you, to exploit you, to extract your prime productive years from you. Don't play along. All you have to do is exit the system. You don't have to play along with the education system. You don't have to play along with big corporate. You don't have to play along with the government. You can go out. You can be free. You can make your own destiny. And I think one of the easiest ways to start with that is, like we were mentioning, I think, in the prior podcast, if you're looking to make a quick move and you have a little bit of savings, you know, like it doesn't even take more than 50 or 100K, you can buy a small mid-sized business, call them SMBs, and start working for yourself right away. And that is a way better investment of your money than going to college. You will learn way more about business and business instincts that are directly applicable to everything else you want to do in business. And so I think to give people a few actionable steps they can start with, there are brokerages around, and I'll be honest, I wasn't very aware of these when I was in college, but there are brokerages around that sell these companies. And these brokerages, if you think about their business model, they have to be really good at vetting a potential seller so that it doesn't waste their time. So when you go to a brokerage, chances are, if he's got a good brand and he's protected his name, he's done a good job of vetting the seller. He's told them what a reasonable valuation is for their company. He's told them, you know, what a reasonable deal structure might be for the exit. And then you can start building that transaction and make that move fairly quickly. And yeah, you might get burned once or twice. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, but it's going to happen really fast. And you could be, you could be miles ahead a year from right now. And that's all without having to learn from scratch, you know, all the ins and outs of writing great copy and all that stuff, right? You can learn those things over time. You can pick up the skills you need to enhance your business over time, but you can get started right away. That's the thing that I never knew when I was starting out. And I wish I had known. It would have made all the difference in the world.
Yeah. So in both cases, we bought our businesses off a website. And just the same way you'd log into a real estate website to see what houses are available, there are websites. I can't think of the name of it now. It's like biz for sale or something. Biz for, like, the number four sale. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head, but you just Google businesses for sale and you'll find one or two websites, and then you put in your zip code or area you want to look, and it'll show you what's available there. And there will be some franchises on there that are nonsense. They're trying to get you to start the franchise for them. I would avoid that if you don't have any experience. That's me personally. But if there's an established business that's running, you know, go ahead and jump in on that if you've got the capital and the time. You check the books, do your due diligence and all that. But if it's cash flow positive, you know, nothing says you can't sell it in a few years down the road. It's actually not as hard as you think. And it's all the benefits you talked about. You're stepping right into a business and you're learning right away. And then from there, you can start to modernize things that were lacking.
This is what the elites don't want you to know. It's this easy. It's this simple. Just get started. Yeah. And that's a great first step. If you wanted to get an even better deal, I bet if you just hit the pavement a little bit and went and, you know, cold contacted quite a few of the small businesses around your town, your city, I bet you could find a few steals in there. I bet you'll find a few business owners who are like, oh, thank God somebody's willing to work.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll hire you for 6 months at this wage and we'll work towards an exit where you buy my company. Thank you for coming. What did your parents do? How did they teach you this?
Yeah. Oh yeah. You'd be amazed. Like, yeah. And there's always people looking to get out. And sometimes you could tell too, when you're dealing with the owner and they're in their 60s or 70s and they have the exhausted look, like they don't really want to be there, but they don't have the savings to leave. They want to turn the business over and that's where they're getting their money from. And a lot of them, you can come into a thing where essentially they maintain say 50% of the equity and you're paying them off month to month to pay off the business. So they're just taking half the profits until you pay them off. And it doesn't, I mean, you structure the deal however you want, but that way you don't even have to walk in with $50,000, $100,000, $500,000 up front. You don't have to take out the loans. They may be willing to carry a significant portion of it. You know, it's just between you and the owner. You got to figure that out for yourselves, but there are options and you should definitely explore them.
We could have an entire podcast on the ins and outs of SMB, M&A, right? So just deal structuring of how to execute these things, but you nailed it. That the seller financing is amazing. It aligns so many incredible incentives. For example, you know, when you're buying a business, you don't know the whole backstory of that business. It may have major liabilities and you have to assess that when you're buying it. But when you have somebody providing seller financing, they're still taking a lot of that risk for a reasonable time into the future. There's a lot of great things to be had there. Plus, a lot of times they'll give you really good interest rates. They know that business inside and out. They know the real risk of that business. And unless they have an immediate large liquidity need, they're probably okay just creating, it's essentially, you know, just a bond for them at that point. So yeah, seller financing is amazing. If you can find somebody who's willing to do that, that's an incredible, you've really pulled the branch all the way down so you can grab what's on it. That's a great way to get started.
Yeah. And you know, the interest rate you're paying, you got to consider that in terms of, you know, your lack of expertise versus how much it's the price you're paying for them to hedge against your lack of expertise in the business space and to pay for their continuing expertise while you're getting on your feet. So the interest rate, it all depends on those things, but don't, even if you're paying a higher interest rate, from the purely financial standpoint, that high interest rates always sound like a bad thing, but you got to look at it in terms of, am I worth a smaller interest rate? You know, am I a liability or not? So be honest with yourself on that to see if it's one finance, as long as it's financially feasible, you know, higher interest rate may just be what's necessary.
There may be a few fields right now where you absolutely have to go to college to do it, like medicine. I don't know if you're in some kind of PhD level science, STEM thing, law, that kind of stuff. Aside from that, man, I imagine how amazing everybody's life would be if when they graduated high school, supposing they go to high school, I'm not recommending it. if at the time they turn 18, they instead buy a business or they instead work at a business and work towards a seller financed acquisition of that business. Imagine how crazy different the world would be. We would have all these self-sufficient people who don't need the government, who didn't become wage slaves, who didn't become indebted to the government through college loans for 50 or 100 or 200 grand. I mean, think about the fact that college debt is the only debt that I know of, at least, that can't be discharged through bankruptcy. There's a reason, right? They are trying to perpetuate that system, that vampiric system.
Look, it's a modern day indentured servitude. I mean, look at the fast one that they just pulled on all the student debt holders, right? Hey, we're going to forgive $10,000 of student debt. Now, as soon as they said that, a lot of knuckleheads ran out there and took on $10,000 of student debt because they thought it would be forgiven. Yeah, what happened? Right after the election, always afterwards, they said, oh, yep, it's illegal. Judge shot it down. Like they didn't know that was going to happen ahead of time. They're like, this is a surprise to anybody that they made a promise of $10,000 of free money and then it just didn't happen. That is the government's biggest asset. Your debt is their biggest asset. They can always control you. They can always get your vote. They can always manipulate you with these programs because you're indebted to them. You're beholden to them.
Just imagine, 4 or 5 generations ago, you know, the early pioneers on the frontier, if they saw the system today and they're like, hey, wait a second, you can be set for life within a couple of years of starting a company, and you instead you chose to sit through classrooms and lectures and spend, not only sit through and waste your time, spend your time, but spend ridiculous amounts of money doing so, you're like, what? You cannot be my great-great-grandkid. There's no way that my genes got that corrupted.
They would have been a slave. Yeah. Oh, yeah. If they saw this now, they'd all punch themselves in the testicles to keep from breeding. Yeah. The question keeps coming up online. You see people asking, your kid turns 18. They just graduated high school. Do you give them $50,000 to go to college, or do you give them $50,000 to start a business? I mean, if your answer is college, you're not paying attention. You have not been paying attention for the last decade, and you're dooming your kids to failure. Congratulations.
So another great time to bring up your point before about using your savings to immediately impact your current situation and not just saving it for retirement, but using your savings to buy a business where you can employ your kids, right? So the modern equivalent of what kids used to do growing up on farms, when we had farms, or family yep. farms at least. They grew up understanding what had to be produced. They grew up understanding how to solve problems, and they were very creative and they were scrappy. We've lost that. So if you have the ability, you know, a great first step is buying a business and having your 10-year-old kid work in that business.
Yeah. So I agree 100%, but I got to add one caveat to that, which is statistically, it's something like 2/3 of second-generation businesses fail. Meaning you build up the business, you employ your kid, you teach your kid, they take over, and then it fails. It's something like 2/3. And now there's a lot of reasons for that, but the TLDR is build your business, employ your kids, but encourage your kids to follow their own entrepreneurial route. Do not pressure them into taking over your business. If you're going to pressure them in anything, it's starting their own business. Because if they're passionate about it, it has a higher success rate than if they try to take over for you. So don't make your kids your retirement plan for your business. You're giving yourself bad odds. But let them see you run the business. Because, I mean, again, I'm a perfect example of this, and my wife. Both of our parents ran their own businesses. We did not pick up on our parents' businesses at all. We started our own. They had to – they're in their own situation of how to get rid of their own business, sell it or shut it down or just run it to the day they die. But we have our own business, and our children are not going to be – they'll learn how to run it, but I have no expectation that they're going to run it for us. And that's just following the data. But yes, absolutely employ your kids and encourage them to start their own business.
Great point. I mean, how much more do you care about something that's your baby that you built from scratch, right? Versus something you've been handed. And sure, like maybe there's a role for, I can just picture if you've got 5 kids and one of them is like kind of just not with it in life, and he's just going to go work for some crappy corporation dead end job that's just going to suck the soul out of him. Maybe his best place in life is taking over the family business. Yeah. maybe that's, you know, well within his reach, and he's not going to, he doesn't have ambitions for anything more than that. And maybe that's a great way to keep him productive and motivated and such. But yeah, everybody else, if they grow up understanding business, the world is their oyster, and they can go out and build whatever they want to contribute to the world. And I mean, what an awesome way for them to find fulfillment and satisfaction in addition to securing for themselves and their kids.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely is keeping your kids employed. So anyway, that's probably going to be where we call it today, unless you've got anything else you want to add in on the several topics we've covered.
I think we really nailed it. I think in the future we'll be able to get into more actionable points, especially because one of the beautiful things about an anonymous podcast is I can talk a lot of deal specifics as I'm going through them, and I'm not worried about blowing the deal. And yeah. So I think one of the things we can do is, you know, as we're working on some of these acquisitions, we're working on some of these financings, we're working on some of these startups, we're working on some of these digital marketing companies and such, we can talk very specific details. But I think over the last few podcasts, we've done a good job of giving you the overview, our worldview, and how to use it to start off on the right foot so that you don't take these massive detours that we took. So for the future, you know, more specific details like pricing strategy, more specific details like how to close the financing you want, the games that they're going to play. For example, you know, when you are about to close a financing round, if some investor starts to think that they're the capstone investor, meaning like they're the one who brings it all together, and they know you have a deadline, they have every incentive to run you into that deadline. So we'll talk details like that on how to prevent those situations from arising. You know, like basic stuff that you wouldn't normally run into until you run into it and it bites you. So stay tuned for that for the future. But I think, the basic story is, yeah, the system is really screwed up. Yeah, the system is made to exploit you, but we were born at this really incredible time in history when we get the chance to turn all that around. We get the chance to become sovereign individuals, to become free on a level that our ancestors could only dream of.
100% agree. You know, yeah, the system is rigged against you, but don't use that as an excuse to be a victim. Don't be a victim. So at that, I'm going to go ahead. We're going to end it here. Just a reminder that nothing you have heard here is to be considered financial advice. It is our opinion, and we always welcome your opinions. We want to know what you think, what topics you want us to get more into, or something you want to challenge us on if you think our opinion is wrong. We definitely want to hear that as well. At that, remember, nobody's coming to save you. It is up to you to save yourself.